Welcome to The Scope, the podcast of gastroenterology and endoscopy news. Dave Robbins, nice to see you. It's been a while. We haven't been recording lately.
We're going to make up for lost time. We got a lot to talk about, so thank you.
That's right, and we're delighted to be joined by a recidivist, Scott Frazier, who's an endoscopy consultant with more than a quarter century of experience in the field. Scott, great to see you again.
Thanks for having me. I've enjoyed this.
So the last time we spoke, you told us about the perilous fate of device reps and industry reps going forward in the post-pandemic world. And now I'd like to talk to you about what's happening with reopening and what you've been seeing and hearing about GI firms that are starting to consider getting patients back in and how they can hope to succeed in the brave new world.
Yeah, thanks. You know, over the course of the last 3+ years, it's really been an education for me as I've worked alongside of some leading private equity firms that are investing in GI. So I've had the opportunity under confidentiality agreements to review financials probably for about 24 leading gastroenterology groups, many of the funded MSO platforms that you see today. And it's given me a real keen appreciation for diversification and diversified clinical lines of service and what it means not only for the strength of the group, but what it also means for the financial stability of the group. And I think there's some really key learnings that I was hoping to share today with your audience.
So Scott, we talked a little bit about the finances moving forward of GI, and in particular, sort of like the two peak model, where there will be obviously after a prolonged recovery period, there will be a ramp up followed by probably a decline as we've sort of burned through those patients who are urgent, who have been warehoused. So what are some strategies that the ASC can look to that perhaps they, for whatever reason, never got involved with pre-pandemic, but require very little investment and ramp up and can sort of fill that void?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'd say the first move is to be proactive with this, not wait for volume to immediately come back to you. All indications are it's going to be slow. There's still a lot of, you know, risk, if you will, associated with that, the full recovery pending, you know, a second wave of COVID. One of the things that I've seen some leading groups do and everyone really has access to that's using an EMR platform is really to start to utilize this incredible data warehouse of your patients. If you don't have the expertise internally, I know a lot of EMR companies have resources that can help do queries and mine data if you're looking at particular, you know, at-risk patient populations. And, you know, I think about that in terms of, you know, the easiest patient population that I think everyone has is looking at surveillance intervals for high-risk patients, whether it's hereditary high-risk patient, you know, 1, 3, 5-year interval, or potentially other at-risk patient populations like high-grade dysplasia patients. You know, an area that I'm really excited about in terms of an ancillary opportunity for GI is in fatty liver disease. I mean, this is a massive, literally and figuratively, patient population. Estimates in the U.S. are 80 million to 100 million patients, of which about 25 million will develop NASH. And we, as a gastroenterology community, do very little to identify those patients. Another area that, you know, I think there's opportunity and you know, help with patient management are arguably some of the most frustrating patients for gastroenterologists to manage, and those are your IBS patients. Really interesting stat that I read recently that a normal IBS patient seeks out 5 different gastroenterologists before getting treated. And it speaks to, you know, I think how frustrating these patients are for the gastroenterologist to manage. They're somewhat of a time suck. You know, there's a lot of understanding the history and the pharmacological management isn't great. That being said, I think everyone is familiar with the FODMAP diet. And the success it's had is just a very hard diet to implement. One of the real innovative things that I've seen during this pandemic has been physician groups that basically are outsourcing their IBS patients to a company that is called Modify Health that basically takes on that patient population, has a dietitian engage that patient walks them through the FODMAP program while they provide an app to manage their symptom scores and their compliance. All that information is then coming back and being fed into the practices EMR. And although it's not huge ancillary revenue, the model that they have now placed and it's been very successfully adopted has been it's about $100 to $150 of ancillary income per patient. And it's better management for these patients. And ironically, the company has seen a real uptick during this pandemic with patients enrolling in this program. I think it speaks to the disease. But, you know, that's one example of, you know, an innovative way to engage patients, a difficult patient population, and keep them at your practice and offer a proven clinical solution for them with the FODMAP diet because of the meal plans that they're delivering.
Just to go back about the NASH program, I think this is not really for ASCs, but you're talking about a joint venture structure through which a busy gastro practice can partner and increase screenings, but then how would they capture revenue from that?
Yeah, basically, if you think about NASH and this massive patient population and the risk factors, these patients are walking in through your clinics every day. They're also coming into your endoscopy centers every day. It's first identifying who is at risk. And what successful groups have implemented has been an easy screening technology that is very low cost called the FibroScan, where they usually have a medical assistant or potentially a nurse that screens a patient ahead of a consult. The screening takes about 3 to 5 minutes, and they're able to assess, you know, the degree of severity that the patient may have with their disease. That is really the first step in identifying a NASH patient population. And I know Dr. Reed Hogan, a GI Associates, who's down in Mississippi, and you know, many is viewed as being one of the leading groups at looking at different ancillary clinical lines that benefit their patients. They implemented a NASH screening program with the FibroScan technology 2 years ago. And in the interview that he recently had, their first year was about 1,800 cases. And I believe their second year was around 2,800 cases. And over the 2 year period, they've had additional profit of over $100,000, just equated to doing that initial screening. That is the first step in identifying the patients. The next step, and where there's a tremendous amount of pharmacological funding for patient enrollment, is clinical research. And, you know, many groups have really shied away from clinical research because it was so difficult, or they got burned with, you know, trying to enroll patients in IBD trials or what have you, and it had big upfront costs. There is a company out there called Objective GI, which structures clinical research organizations in practices in a joint venture. They bring in the protocols, they bring in the employees, they train the employees, they have policies and procedures, and they manage your clinical research entity so you as a practitioner can refer potential patients over to the clinical research organization to enroll patients in these trials. And this, again, is what they like to refer to as a frictionless ancillary line and clinical offering for patients. And the revenue models are very impressive, you know, with the first year potential ancillary income being over 100,000, and in some cases, over the course of about 4 years, growing to over 600,000. So without a lot of upfront investment, you know, honestly, one of the biggest investments is finding space in your office for a clinical research organization to exist. So, you know, the NASH research area is emerging, and, you know, seeing and looking at some of these groups that have pursued it, it has become a great clinical service line that they're offering to their patient population and attracting new patients into their practice because of it.
So, Scott, speaking of ancillaries, one of the things that we've covered a fair amount in Gastro News has been hemorrhoid treatment. Is that something that more groups should consider getting into?
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting for gastroenterologists and many friends that, you know, have made very successful living in this field of gastroenterology. There's a huge reluctance to do hemorrhoidal treatment, hemorrhoidal banding, hemorrhoidal ablation. And I kind of joke, I think it's a total proximity bias. Even though you all work every day in the colon and the anus, you don't necessarily like being, you know, within 18 inches of it. You like being 4 or 5 feet away from it. Which is understandable. But, you know, looking at some of the leading groups and financials, the hemorrhoidal programs that they have are very favorable. And it's an easy procedure to do, either banding or ablation. and the reimbursement is considerable, and you're offering your patients a service. You are diagnosing hemorrhoids every day. It's then in the clinical consults identifying whether the patient has ever suffered pain from this hemorrhoid. Then there is a reason to do this clinically relevant treatment. And it's easy and it's proven. I think it's just getting over that bias. And, you know, so much of what I talked about is gastroenterologists are trained in all these different treatment and diseases that we discussed, but there's been really a reluctance to embrace a lot of it because colonoscopy has been so lucrative, or I've always referred to this colonoscopy currency mindset. And now more than ever is a time for us to think, you know, what are we trained in? What type of patients do we see? Use our EMRs and access those patients and really offer our patients more clinical value and treatment options when they're coming into our clinics or our ASCs. The patients are there. It's just identifying them and providing these additional treatments or diagnostic technologies.
That's right, Scott. And just to dovetail, we touched a little bit on this last time. The patients that have reluctance to go to the hospital, because obviously many hospitals are either going through various stages of reopening that may be lagging behind ASCs, but also, you know, fears about the fact that they have seen COVID cases, and there may be even some mixed populations that still haven't been fully sorted out. The segue of advanced procedures into the space of the freestanding ASC. So, you know, I'm not necessarily talking about ERCP, but certainly endoscopic ultrasound with biopsy, and now because of the recently released CMS ASC codes for confocal microscopy, that could be, you know, another way to think outside the box. So what does that look like?
Yeah, it's interesting. I know EUS is still emerging, I would say, as an ASC ancillary or advanced imaging service line. In some markets, there's, you know, with private payers, there is reimbursement. I know, Dave, at your endoscopy center, you perform EUS. There's a few other centers around the country that do this, but it's not widely adopted yet. And obviously, the equipment is very costly. The confocal microscopy, which has been around for almost two decades and is widely used at a lot of academic centers for working up, you know, the high-grade dysplasia patient, really through the reimbursement efforts. I know the ASG was instrumental in this as well, getting a Category 1 code established as an adjunct to EGD with biopsy. So whatever your normal rate is for EGD with biopsy, you would then use the confocal probe, pass it down through the gastroscope, and assess the suspected area. The procedure, you know, itself takes, you know, anywhere from 5 to 10 minutes. But the economics with CMS and the new CMS coding and coverage have afforded endoscopy centers that are doing this an additional $600 to $650 or so per case. And the company has been very responsive in doing a fee for procedure model as a response to this COVID environment and capital equipment being frozen. So it's a way basically to bring in the equipment, only pay for it when you use it, and has a very favorable ROI model. Plus, it benefits these high-grade dysplasia patients with a higher diagnostic yield and a better, you know, clinical algorithm to treatment.
Yeah, the fee for procedure model is generally one that most centers pre-pandemic shied away from because it generally didn't make sense when looked at over the course of, say, a three-year, you know, traditional lease, for example. So I wonder to what extent are companies who themselves are hurting financially are perhaps willing to renegotiate their, not only their equipment leases, but their service contracts, and to what extent that would set a new normal such that when recovery is complete, let's say a year from now, if they're going to be in a position where they've shot themselves in the foot.
It's a great question. And I think, you know, there are a lot of contracts, whether with a scope manufacturer, whoever's doing your scope repairs, your device manufacturer, your infection control supplies. And, you know, the first thing, and as well as your leases, you know, your lease on your office or your ASC space. And, you know, one of the things that I've appreciated working with private equity and a lot of law firms has been there's really a playbook that they deploy when there is financial stress on an asset. The first thing is to review contracts and to renegotiate contracts. And, you know, I think all medical providers right now really have the benefit of, you are the first line responders to this epidemic. And it is critical as a manufacturer, as a landlord, to not disrupt your business. And I think more and more people are realizing that. So, you know, I would encourage ASC owners, you know, to spend the time and maybe hire legal counsel to review your contracts, because there are clauses, there are out clauses. And then I would argue that not every landlord or manufacturer is going to enforce that contract during a pandemic. And, you know, I've seen some locally here in Philadelphia. There was a story that made national news about a real estate holding company that owned a hospital, and he refused to open that hospital. Well, the lash out at this gentleman made national news, and probably he will never show his face again in Philadelphia because of the sympathy that the community and the city had for healthcare workers. You know, he was unwilling to open a hospital that had recently shut down and was asking an exorbitant amount of money to do so. And, you know, I think that can be said, you know, for all of you that are running medical practices, medical facilities, is to work with your manufacturers, to work with your landlord on something that will be in line with your projected revenue recovery, because you don't want to be operating in the red month after month after month because of the leases that you've signed up for.
Right. So, yeah, we've had varying success with that here in New York. Unfortunately, most of the time, the landlords are willing to defer rent or tack it on to the existing lease, but there's not a whole lot of negotiation here for that. But I know it varies very much regionally. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about another way industry might be able to help. And this is, again, about creating that culture and narrative of safety. Is there a way that industry can help with, whether through media or other marketing campaigns, in a meaningful way to try to bring those patients back in, again, trying to address this gap between the urgent cases and the elective cases that are now increasingly coming online?
Absolutely. A lot of large industry partners, you know, have dedicated marketing dollars for regional or local campaigns. Sometimes they're tied to a specific product. Other times they're tied to an overall patient population. And, you know, I think it's working with your industry partners and first inquiring what type of programs that they have. One of the things that I've been impressed by has been some of the resources that industry has towards social media and social media outreach and the algorithms that they use for social media outreach. And this is inexpensive, but it's incredibly effective with certain patient populations. I know the IBD patient population is very, very active on social media. Groups, along with some of the biologic companies, have been very successful in partnering together to activate patient populations in a certain market where they're driving those patient populations to their infusion centers. And, you know, that's probably a great example of, you know, partnering with an industry partner that has the capabilities to do that, where you as a medical group may not have a marketing or social media guru, and you might have to outsource it. Your suppliers of some of these biological agents do. Sometimes it's just asking what type of support that they have. The device manufacturers also have programs that support, you know, patient recruitment efforts around some of their technologies. So it's, you know, we're very much in this together. And, you know, my clients that I advise, you know, to adopt strategies to help with this recovery, I really feel will be the stronger industry suppliers coming out of this pandemic than the companies that continue to try to do business as usual.
So we've been speaking with Scott Fraser, an endoscopy industry consultant. Scott, we'd like to check back in with you in a couple of weeks and see how things are unfolding, but it's always great to get your perspective.
Thanks, guys. I look forward to it, and stay safe during this yellow phase that we're in.
You too.
Great. Thanks a lot, Scott. We'll see you soon.